Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes. I hope that your Christmas was filled with joy and that whether you're one of those who celebrate Christmas like I do or not, that you're experiencing that truth this time of year, that it really is better to give than to receive. Fresno State football season is over, which means this program won't be interrupted again for a while. And I think this last 2009 edition of Hometown Heroes will be a very enlightening and entertaining one. In the past week, I've been all over the western United States calling sporting events, and in Missoula, Montana, I had the chance to sit down with a gentleman named David J. Thatcher. He's one of just nine surviving members of a very select group, the 80 airmen who carried out one of the most legendary missions in American history. It took place on April 18, 1942. Mr. Thatcher was a gunner on the B-25 Ruptured Duck, piloted, as it happened, by Fresno native Ted Lawson. The Ruptured Duck, along with 15 other modified B-25s, took off from the USS Hornet that day for what shaped up, in all honesty, to be a suicide mission. If you've never seen the movie 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, you might want to go rent it after listening to Mr. Thatcher describe his role in the Doolittle Raid. Those 30 Seconds Over Tokyo changed history, boosting morale in America just 5 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and also sending a message to Imperial Japan that the mainland was vulnerable. Of the 80 men who boldly took off that morning on a top-secret mission, three were captured and later executed by the Japanese. Four died in Japanese prisoner of war camps. Four more survived the duration of the war in those camps. And the rest of them, 69 out of 80, all managed to make it back to Allied forces. It was the longest mission ever carried out by B-25s, and surviving raiders have managed to get together for annual reunions now for decades. Two of those reunions were actually held in Fresno. The most recent reunion was attended by just four of the nine surviving raiders. And one of them is the 88-year-old Montana man you'll hear from today. You may have heard that Jimmy Doolittle, the leader of that mission, thought in its aftermath that it was a failure, that he'd be court-martialed when and if he made it out of Japanese-occupied territory. Instead, he would receive the Congressional Medal of Honor and was promoted from lieutenant colonel all the way to brigadier general. It is the stuff of legend, and today we'll get a first-hand account from a very unassuming and humble hero. He was just 20 years old when he took to the sky that fateful morning, not knowing if he would ever make it back to his native Big Sky country. Little did he know how significant that mission, his very first mission, would become. Like all the veterans you've heard from on this program, he insists he was just doing his job like any one of the 16 million other Americans who served in World War II. He was awarded the Silver Star for helping the rest of his crew to safety after the Ruptured Duck crash-landed in China. And like every other raider, he also received the Distinguished Flying Cross. To make more time for uninterrupted dialogue today, I'll go ahead and catch our first break early here. When we come back, David Thatcher tells us about his role in Doolittle's raid over Tokyo, the events leading up to it, and how he escaped afterwards. We'll relive history through his firsthand account right after this. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It's a great thrill today to bring you a conversation with David J. Thatcher. And if you haven't heard that name, you definitely know one of the major events that he was involved with, an event that many would say changed the world, and certainly one of the most recognizable events of World War II, the Doolittle Raid. It was April 18th of 1942, and we're going to hear how he was intimately involved in that. But I want to start a little before that. David, you grew up in Montana, a Montana boy. Graduated from high school, and how long did you wait to enlist?
Year and a half after high school.
So that was pretty close to when Pearl Harbor happened that you enlisted.
A year and 4 days before Pearl Harbor.
Did you, a lot of people that ended up in the Army Air Corps tell me that they went into that branch of service because they wanted to be a pilot. Was that your story?
I just wanted to get into airplanes, yes.
You just wanted to fly one way or another. So tell me about where you were when Pearl Harbor happened. I imagine you probably already started doing quite a bit of training by then.
I was in Lincoln, Nebraska, going to airplane mechanic school. I was there when Pearl Harbor happened, there until the 19th of December, 1941.
What do you remember about that day, about December 7th? Do you remember where you were when you found out and what it felt like, what it meant to you at the time?
It was Sunday afternoon. We had gone to a movie. We came out of the movie and heard about it then.
Did you immediately realize that this isn't a game anymore? There's going to be some real action real soon?
No. things didn't seem to be much different.
But they would be in a few months. And in fact, it was only 2 weeks after that, the way I understand it, that President Roosevelt first said, had the idea of a strike on the Japanese mainland, which Japan was telling its people could not happen. And then a few months after that, someone came up with the idea of flying bombers off of aircraft carriers. But I imagine you didn't know anything about any of that, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Tell me about how you got assigned to your squadron and what your understanding was about what you guys were going to do.
Well, I was in the 95th Bombardment Squadron of the 17th Bomb Group, and that was the first group in the U.S. Army Air Corps to begin training in B-25s. So all the Raiders were picked out of that group. They had had more training than any other group in the Army Air Corps at that time.
And so you got assigned as a gunner on a B-25. Where on the plane were you?
I was on a machine gun turret on top of the airplane.
Now, the original B-25 had another gun turret, but by the time you guys ended up overseas, that was going to be a little different. But when did you, the way I understand it, at some point someone went around and said, we need volunteers for a dangerous mission that we can't tell you about. Is that what you remember, or was it a little different?
Well, I wanted to do some flying. I was just a mechanic on the ground, so I volunteered for this crew, but had no idea where we're going to go or what we're going to do.
Did they give you any kind of warning that the transition from mechanic to gunner might make things a little more dangerous, put you in harm's way a little more?
None whatever.
Would you have been worried about it anyway?
No, I'm sure I would not have.
All right, so here you are. It's early 1942. You guys end up training and some top secret training in Florida, as I understand. From what I hear, they marked the runway to mimic what an aircraft carrier would have been in terms of length to figure out if a B-25 could actually take off and land in that short of a distance?
Yes, that was at Eglin Field in Florida. We did not make any of those fancy takeoffs at the main base because we didn't want anyone to see what we were doing. They had an auxiliary field out in the timber. That's where they had the runway marked off in certain distances.
So by this time, are you starting to get a clue that something's up here, that you guys are doing something very unique?
Yes, especially since we had a Navy pilot from Pensacola checking out all the pilots. He had flown off an aircraft carrier to see if they could get off in a certain distance.
And I imagine by this time, too, in addition to a Navy pilot, there is a pilot by the name of Doolittle who you'd run across once or twice. Did you guys know who he was? Was he a big deal yet?
Yes, I remember in peacetime that he'd won some trophies flying. And he came down there we first met him at Eglin. He came and introduced to us, and he was supposed to be our commander.
What kind of guy was he? Because obviously there's been a lot written about him. He's been portrayed in the movies. You've been portrayed in the movies. But how would you describe Jimmy Doolittle as a human being?
Well, he was pretty short. He's probably one of the shortest guys on the raid. But he's very efficient. He not only knew all about airplanes, but about the engines and every part of them.
Now, by this time, while you're training in Florida, did you have the crew that you would end up flying with on the ruptured duck? Were you already intact as a crew at that point?
Yes. Went down there with that crew and began training with that crew all the time.
And your pilot on that crew, Ted Lawson, was actually born in Fresno, believe it or not. And he, of course, wrote the book, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, that turned into a movie. How close were you with him? And did you guys appreciate his skills in the cockpit?
Yes, we did. It was a very close, knit crew. So we all knew each other very well. So.
And was it around this time that your plane was dubbed the Ruptured Duck? Because I understand at first it didn't have any nose art or any name on the nose.
There was originally six crew on the crew, but the one crew, when they took all the radio equipment out, they wouldn't need a radio gunner. So, but one day he was out there and used some chalk and drew a picture of Donald Duck bandaged up with a couple of crutches. So then that was just in chalk, but soon after that, the other crews nicknamed the plane the Ruptured Duck. So.
And it had gotten banged up on a practice landing or something a little bit to lead to that nickname, or is that not true?
None whatever, huh?
So that's one of the myths. See, this is what I love about talking to someone who was actually there. You can expose the myths and find out what was really true about your crew. Now, you mentioned taking the radio equipment out, and that brings me to another important question, because you had trained in B-25s, and then you're starting to see, well, they're changing these B-25s. Tell me about some of the modifications that were made to these planes and if that started to pique your curiosity a little bit.
Well, before the planes went down to Columbia, South Carolina, they were at Minneapolis. They took the bottom turret out because we knew we would be flying so low that no enemy fighter could get underneath of us, and we wouldn't need oxygen. So they took all that weight out, the oxygen tanks and all that, and all just about all the radio equipment, because we had to fly silent all the time. So.
Because that was such a top secret mission, you didn't want to be detected. And the other thing, the thing they added to the plane, were pretend guns pointing backwards, decoy guns that weren't real, and also gas tanks, just about doubled the fuel capacity, right?
Yeah, in the place at the bottom turret, they put a 60-gallon leak-proof tank in there that if a bullet goes through it, it'll self-seal. In the top of the bomb bay, they put a tank in there, over 100 gallons, that was leak-proof also. And there was still room for 400 or 500-pound bombs below the tank.
Now, forgive me for asking a really dumb question, because I think the listeners would rather hear your explanation than mine. Why were they doing all this? Why were they changing the plane so much? What was the purpose of all these modifications?
For long-distance flying.
So you lengthened the distance that the plane would be able to fly, and you also had to be able to take off on an aircraft carrier. Which did you find that out? When did you find that out, that you guys were expected to take off and land on an aircraft carrier in a bomber?
They didn't tell us. We just figured it out ahead of time. We figured that for that training, it would be taking off an aircraft carrier, and we thought where else would be going to but Japan. So.
And it, as far as I understand, it still remains the only time that Air Force or Army Air Corps planes took off from a Navy carrier, right?
No, they practiced it off the coast of Virginia. They put two lightweight airplanes on board and make sure they could get off.
But the only time in an actual mission that it happened. So they send you from Florida, and you head west briefly to Sacramento, then to Alameda, and then they finally do put you on an aircraft carrier. Of course, everyone knows it was the USS Hornet, which I'm sure you've been on since then with all the reunions. Tell me about what that was like when you actually got on the ship with these planes. There's 16 planes. There's 80 crew members. It's a pretty small unit to be taking on a pretty big task.
Well, they put extra gasoline in. There's a crawlway on above the bomb bay between there and on top of the airplane, just large enough to crawl from the back end to the front end. So they put a collapsible rubber tank in there that held over 100 gallons. And then after I got in on the airplane, they handed me up a dozen 5-gallon cans of gasoline, so I had that in the back with me. When we flew from Sacramento then to Alameda, and on the way we flew under the Oakland Bay Bridge and pulled up to the dock right beside the Hornet.
So did all the planes fly under the bridge, or was that Lawson's trick?
I don't think any of the others did.
How'd the rest of you feel about that? Were you applauding them or telling them he was crazy?
I enjoyed it.
I talked to a B-24 pilot once who flew under the Golden Gate Bridge, so you're right up there with him. Once you get on the Hornet and you see how many of you there are, you know what the training has been, you know this is going to be a dangerous mission. Are you excited? You a little nervous? You scared? What's going through your mind?
When they pulled up the dock beside the carrier, then they just hoisted the airplane up on the deck, and I stayed in the plane so I could lock the brakes when they set it down on the deck of the carrier. So I did not walk aboard, and I did not walk off the carrier.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are 16 pilots in this group of Raiders.
They had extra pilots and crews on in case someone got sick or something like that.
But of the pilots that were expected to take off of an aircraft carrier, how many of them had ever taken off in a bomber from an aircraft carrier before?
None of them.
Exactly. And that's just incredible to me when you think back about it. Well, I think that's a good point to take our commercial break. We're talking to David Thatcher, one of just 9 remaining survivors of the famed Doolittle Raiders. When we come back, we'll talk about once they set off on the Hornet and what triggered the takeoff of their famous mission over Tokyo in April of 1942. We'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm talking today in Missoula, Montana with David Thatcher, one of just a few remaining survivors of the Doolittle Raid and the lone survivor of his crew on the Ruptured Duck, a B-25 piloted by Ted Lawson, a Fresno native who ended up writing the book 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, later turned into a movie starring Spencer Tracy and Van Johnson, and Robert Walker as our guest today, David Thatcher. How'd you feel about Robert Walker playing you, by the way? Did he do a good job?
I think he did, yeah.
How did your wife feel about it?
About the same.
Fair enough. Well, let's get back to where we were. You're on the USS Hornet, leaving the San Francisco Bay Area just after April Fool's Day in 1942. You're heading out with a pretty big group, the Task Force 16, with Bull Halsey in command of the whole thing. The Enterprise is part of your escort. Not yet. When'd you meet up with them? You set me straight. Enough of me talking. I want to hear from you.
We had the Hornet and then two cruisers and four destroyers and a tanker. There was just the eight in the task force when I left there. And we got just out of San Francisco a ways, and then they announced over the loudspeaker that our destination was Japan. And there was a huge shout went up over the whole aircraft carrier. No one had said anything about where we were going up until then.
Had you had your suspicions that it might be Japan? I'm sure that's where everyone wanted to attack.
Yes, we thought that's where we'd be going, yes.
And again, the genesis of this was got to find some way to strike back at the Japanese, not as much for the physical damage, but for the psychological damage to show the Japanese they could be hit and give America a morale boost. I bet you didn't quite have that all figured out yet at that time.
No, not at that time, no.
Anything of note that stands out to you between when you left the Golden Gate and when you got to that morning of April 18th when the mission actually happened?
The Navy wasn't very well pleased with having Army personnel aboard, but after they treated us pretty well, they let me sleep in a bed instead of a hammock.
Are you saying other guys didn't get that treatment?
I don't think so. Not on any Navy ship. The Army didn't, I don't think.
Did they pull any pranks on you guys, or they just talked a lot of stuff?
Nope, they didn't on me anyhow.
Well, and you were the only enlisted man on your crew, as I understand.
Yes, that's right.
Were you treated any differently in that capacity?
No.
So you get closer and closer to April 18th, and as I understand it, the events of that day actually got triggered sooner than they were supposed to. Surprise, surprise. Funny how that happens in war. Tell me how that developed.
Before that, we met up with another small task force, and it had the carrier Enterprise. It had also had two cruisers and four destroyers and a tanker. And the Hornet could not launch or recover its aircraft while we were on board. So they had the Enterprise along to try and protect the task force from aerial fighting.
That's a pretty good security blanket. You know what the Big E went on to do the rest of the war and had been there at Pearl Harbor, outside the harbor, too. Well, let's move along to that morning, April 18th. Did you have any butterflies that day? How much did you know about what you guys were going to be doing? Walk us through that day as you experienced it.
Well, we knew what our target was. Each of the pilots got a chance to pick what target they wanted. So, and our target was the Nippon Steel Factory in Tokyo. But that morning, we heard the sort of explosion, guns going off, and immediately they announced over the loudspeaker, Army pilots, man your plane. So we had to get ready and go up on deck.
Did that get your blood pumping a little bit, get you excited?
Yes, it did.
I can imagine how it would. And as I understand it, Doolittle made the decision to leave 10 hours earlier because your task force had been detected. So this added 170 miles on a range that was already at its limit, right?
I think Bull Halsey pretty much made the decision that as long as we run into a Japanese fishing boat out there, that we were afraid they'd warn Japan that there was a task force out there. So we had to take off then.
What was it like on your crew as you guys took off? Did you have any idea how historic a mission this was going to be?
None whatever. We figured just another bombing missions.
But this is obviously your first mission.
Yes, for every one of us, yes.
So you weren't nervous at all?
Just pretty excited, all right.
Was there anything that you guys did, maybe said something to each other, said a little prayer, talked about this or that, or were you all just keeping your mouth shut because you all knew what you were doing?
And had to concentrate on what we were doing, yes.
And what were your duties? I know the plane had 400 or 500-pound bombs, but you're on that top turret gun, so are you just looking for enemy aircraft to shoot at or what?
I would just keep a lookout. I had 250 caliber machine guns in the turret. and I could see everything from up there in all directions, so I had a ringside seat.
So I've heard these B-25s, these heavily modified B-25s, described as flying gas cans. Was that something that you guys used as a characterization, or something that you've heard since?
Probably something heard since.
But you knew that this was a kind of a crazy mission, that you were not going to make it back to the ship. Was that clear to you beforehand?
No way of ever coming back to the ship. We couldn't land on the aircraft carrier. We just had to go ahead.
So you were hoping to drop your bombs over Tokyo and land somewhere in China, right?
Yes.
Tell me about how this played out. What was it like approaching your target? What was the mood when the bombs were dropped, and what happened after that? I'll let you just tell the narrative for a little while.
Well, we were flying just 50 feet over the water. As we came in over the beach, it was Saturday, right at noon, a beautiful day, and there's hundreds of people along the beach. So as we flew overhead, they were waving to us. I could see the expressions on their faces as they were cheering. I'm sure they thought we were Japanese planes. After we left the coast, then before we got to Tokyo, we met a formation of six planes. But we were flying so low that it's difficult to see an airplane that's flying right over the ground. With the olive drab color they were, and they passed overhead, and I guess they didn't even see us. They just kept on going the direction we were coming.
But you saw them. You knew they were coming, so you were probably at the ready on your 50 calibers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then before we got to Tokyo, we could see the anti-aircraft fire exploding because we did not go in formation. We went in alone. So six of the other airplanes had been ahead of us, so they drew the anti-aircraft fire. Then we had to climb to 1,500 feet to drop our bombs so they wouldn't blow us out of the air when they exploded. We had three 500-pound demolition and one 500-pound incendiary cluster. The three 500-pound demolition went at an angle down to the target, but the incendiary cluster, when it fell out of the airplane, it scattered into 126 individual bombs to scatter over the area that had been exploded from the other bombs, so to start fires. There wasn't quite a bit of anti-aircraft fire over Tokyo itself, but it wasn't very accurate. I guess they hadn't had any practice yet.
Well, yeah, just like Pearl Harbor was a sneak attack, a surprise attack, this was every bit as much a surprise attack, and there were probably a lot of people, like you said, that thought they were Japanese planes. But I'm trying to put myself in your shoes and in your head, and you're already flying this flying gas can, as I said, with a range that it's not designed to make. You can't come back to the ship. You don't know where you're going to land. You see six planes coming at you. You know there's probably more. It sounds a lot like a suicide mission. Did that ever occur to you that this might be a suicide mission?
No, we didn't plan on that at all. We figured we could reach China all right, even though we had to take off 250 miles farther out than we'd planned to. Our original plan was to take off in the evening and fly over Japan at night and reach China the next morning after daylight. As it was, we had to take off at 9 in the morning. We rode over Japan in the daytime and then finally arrived on the coast of China, it was about dark.
I'm really intrigued by that period of time between when you dropped the bombs and when you landed, or crash landed, as the case happened to be. At what point did you realize this is it? The gas has run out, or we've got to put it down? Was there any discussion among the crew? Did you guys just all trust Lawson to handle it, or what were those moments like?
No, we figured he could handle it, whether we tried to land in the water or fly up high and bail out.
When did you find out that he was going to put it in the water, that this was it? And tell our listeners where that was and how that all happened.
Well, we finally reached what we saw land, and he spotted a strip of beach, and he thought they could set it down there. So we had the wheel down, but it was almost dark and raining, and visibility was poor. And we hit the water with the wheel down, and immediately stopped us and turned us over.
What did that feel like? I can't imagine.
Well, I was knocked unconscious for a while, and I was in the back of the airplane. The other four were all thrown out through the nose of the airplane. When I came to in the back of the airplane, I wasn't completely conscious, and I could see water coming in what I thought was the bottom of the airplane. So I tried to get out there and then come to realize the plane was upside down and the plexiglass on the turret had shattered. And that's where the water was coming in. So I was able to go back and open the escape hatch on the bottom of the airplane, crawled out on the belly of the airplane.
Which was now the top.
Yes. And then walked back towards the tail of the airplane. And when I stepped off in the water, it was about waist deep. So I was able to wade to shore. By that time, the other four crew were already up on the shore. They were very seriously injured. And there was some people up on a bank there, and they heard the crash, so they came down there, and we didn't know if they were Chinese or Japanese, but the first thing they wanted to know, we couldn't understand it, but they pointed to the fingers on their hand, and then they pointed to each one of us, and then they pointed out to the airplane, so they figured by that they wanted to know if there was just the five of us in there. So then they helped us up to a little village there overnight.
I don't want to interrupt you here, but and I know that you, like every veteran I've interviewed, are very humble about what you did. But the government gave you a Silver Star for what you did. And tell me what you did with the other four men, because from what I've read, you had to help them significantly with first aid and making sure that they'd got off that beach.
We went down on a Japanese-occupied island off the coast of China, but the underground there helped us get out of there. And the next morning, then, none of the four of them could walk, so they had to be carried on makeshift stretchers. We had to cross the island, so they used a bamboo, sort of a bamboo pallet to tie up to a bamboo pole so two coolies could carry each one of the guys on their shoulders. And the guerrilla leader on the island there, before I left, I went back to the airplane after daylight and tried to find a first aid kit. But then I saw that the airplane was upside down, the main landing gear was sticking up in the air, and the engines and propellers were quite a ways out in the water. But we must have hit the bottom when we crashed, because the full front end of the airplane, clear back to the leading edge of the wings, was smashed flat. So if they hadn't been thrown out, they'd have never got out alive.
So were you able to find some materials to render first aid?
No, I couldn't find anything but packs of cigarettes floating around in the plane.
That might have made someone feel a little better, but it wasn't going to do a whole lot of good. So you, along with these Chinese nationals, help the injured guys. You weren't banged up at all? I know you were just not even 21 yet, just 20 years old, but you weren't hurt at all?
I was had a pretty bad bump on the top of my head from, that's what knocked me unconscious, I guess. But otherwise than that, I was not hurt.
So what's going through your mind at this point? I mean, there are so many moments where you probably thought this could be it, but did you think you were going to get out of there alive? I mean, I can't imagine what it must have been like to you in that situation.
We didn't know if we would or not. If it hadn't been the Chinese, we'd have been captured.
How did they get you out of there and back to Allied forces?
We left that spot where we crashed at 11 o'clock in the morning. We found out later that the Japanese landed 65 Jap soldiers, and they came looking for us, but we had a head start on them. Had to go all the way across the island and went by a sampan then to the mainland. It took us 2 days to get to free territory at the little town of Haiyu on the coast. Then it took us another day to reach a hospital. They had to be carried all that time.
I imagine everyone's getting pretty exhausted and probably pretty hungry by now, too.
Well, we did have some food, but they were in pain all the time because we didn't have and had nothing to relieve their pain.
Would you say that's something, I'm sure the crew was close ahead of time, but at this point, do you think it brought the crew closer together to be going through this incredible ordeal together?
Yes, I'm sure it did, yes.
So what happened next? Where did they take you from there?
From the hospital, they got to the hospital, and we were there at Lynn Hyatt for 3 days, and then another crew made a good water landing on an island out farther than we were. The airplane floated for 8 minutes, and they were able. They had the only medical doctor that was on the raid with them, and they were able to get his black bag out, get the stuff into the life raft, but in landing in the water, a sharp edge of one of the flaps had turned up. As they pushed the life raft off the wing, it punctured one half the life raft and dumped everything in the water. So they were able to cling to the raft to get ashore. And they came to the island of Dandine where we were, and my co-pilot, Dean Davenport, had given his passport to the guerrilla leader on the island, so they knew we were ahead of them and needed medical attention. So they caught up with us at Lin Hai 3 days after we got there. And then I went on with their crews because I was no more used to my crew, and the docks quite stayed with their crew and to take care of them.
And all this time, I'm sure none of you had any idea how successful your raid was or what kind of significance it would have or what happened to all the other crews, right?
That's right. We didn't hear until we got a big city on the Yangtze River, Hanyang. We finally found out about the other crews there. So then I went on with that crew, and it took us a couple more days of pretty much walking and being carried in sedan chairs. The Chinese had blown up all the roads along the coast to slow the advance of the Japanese. So all there was trails down through the rice paddies that traveled.
This is not what you imagined when you're a Montana boy signing up for the Army Air Corps. What was that moment like when you finally saw American officers and enlisted men again and realized, you know what, I'm not going to spend the rest of this as a POW?
Well, at Lin Hai, there was an English missionary and his wife, and they could translate for us then, so that helped a lot. We finally reached Hanyang, and a good-sized city, after traveling almost every means of transportation you could think of. They had an airbase there. So we waited 3 days for an airplane to come in from Chongqing to pick us up. And those 3 days, the Japanese would come over and bomb the city and bomb the airport because the Chinese didn't have anything to shoot us at them with. Every day we'd go up the river in a tug and get out on the shore and hike up to a pagoda on the top of a hill there. The fourth morning they came in and picked us up, the airplane got in. Well, that day, the Japanese came over and bombed and strafed that pagoda. They knew what we were doing. They had spies through there.
Man, close call after close call after close call. And one of the things that's most incredible to me is that so many survived. There were only a few, I believe, 8 ended up as prisoners of war. 3 were executed by the Japanese, which is a great tragedy. But the other tragedy in this, the Chinese that helped you. I've read as many as 250,000 civilians were killed by the Japanese to punish them for helping you.
Mm-hmm. They went through, and as they kept advancing, they'd wipe out the towns and villages that helped us, any of them. Yes.
I imagine that just has to really be hard to deal with and hard to swallow, and makes you that much more grateful to those people who did help you, who saved your life. And in the end, I imagine a lot of the people that helped you probably died, right?
Yes, that's for sure. I'm sure they did, yes. Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you guys, when you get together at your reunions and you have every year forever, is that something that you talk about?
Not very much. We were very conscious of it, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, I think we're at another point to take a brief break. But when we come back, we'll talk about what Mr. Thatcher did the rest of the war and how this whole Doolittle Raider phenomenon has impacted his life since then. David Thatcher of Missoula, Montana, our guest today. We'll be back with the rest of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As is often the case, I'm sure there won't be enough time to cover everything that David Thatcher could tell us about his experiences in World War II. He probably wouldn't take the time to tell you that he was awarded the Silver Star or the Distinguished Flying Cross. The DFC went to all of the Doolittle Raiders after their incredible mission in April of 1942. And before we wrap up that chapter of your story, I know it's been said many times that Doolittle believed, after he landed famously in a pile of dung that saved his ankle, he said that the mission was a failure because it didn't do that much damage, all the planes were lost, and he expected to be court-martialed when he got back. Was that a thought that entered any of your minds, or when you heard that he had said that, what was your reaction?
No, I'm sure it wasn't. We all figured it was a successful mission. And
when you finally did hear about what happened, about how many guys got out of there, saw how big of a deal it was for America to have that strike on Japan, Did that give you a sense of pride, of accomplishment? Did that make you feel good?
Yes, it did. We just figured it was another mission. We didn't figure it would be that important.
I think it's pretty important. I think that's probably been a hammered home for you many times over the years. But you weren't done. You had most of the war still to go. And you had some interesting adventures along the way. They had to get you back to the States, and then they were sending you over to Europe on the Queen Mary, and you saw something that you didn't expect?
First part of October, we were off on the Queen Mary. We were off the coast of Ireland, and a dozen U.S. and British destroyers met us to escort us into Glasgow, Scotland. One destroyer crossed in front of the Queen Mary twice. The third time they didn't make it. It was cut in two by the Queen Mary. It just feel a bump when that happened. The Queen Mary is so huge.
Just felt like a speed bump.
Yes, that's right.
Once you realize what happened, probably all of you on board are helpless to do anything about it, right?
Yes.
And those are the things that we don't think about that much in war, but they happen all the time. So you end up getting across that way. You end up flying a lot of missions out of North Africa. I believe you flew 26 bombing missions. Were any of those, did you ever have the same kind of feeling that you had on April 18th, 1942? Were you just as nervous and on edge for those as you were back on that day?
Yes, the anti-aircraft fire was quite accurate from when I was bombing the cities. And we were fortunate to have fighter escort all the way to Target and back by then. But we did run into a lot of enemy fighters.
And I should point out that you're now on the crew of a B-26, the B-26 Marauder, not the B-25. And so you were on the first mission to bomb Tokyo, and you're also on the first mission to bomb another strategic city on another front of the war. Tell our listeners about that.
On the 19th of July, 1942, I was on the first mission over Rome, Italy. And that day, there were 600 airplanes in the sky. Look every direction, see airplanes.
And you guys realized how significant that was as far as the big picture.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And like I said, we don't have time to bring everything up that you experienced. I'm sure there are other close calls you could tell me about, other things that you're very proud of. Did you ever think when you got into the war, when you signed up for the Army Air Corps as a boy from Montana, waiting to turn, 19 probably at that time, did you ever imagine that you would fight the Japanese, the Germans, and be in on as many huge moments in the war as you were?
No, I just enlisted for 3 years and hoped to see the Northwest in that 3 years.
You saw some other parts of the world on the way. What did it mean to you when, you're in the European theater, so at that point, VE Day, tell me about that and what it meant to you. And then after that, a few months later, VJ Day, that theater which you had kind of started from an American point of view finally came to an end. Tell me about those 2 days and what they meant to you.
I was just in North Africa all in 1943, so I was back in the United States when they invaded France and also when VE Day. And then I was able to get out of the service before VJ Day because I'd had enough points to get out. I'd been in for 4.5 years then. So.
I'm sure that still meant a lot to you, though. Was it relief? Was it elation? How would you describe the feeling?
Yes, I was very happy to see it happen. Then a lot of the servicemen could return home.
Like you already had, and I'm glossing over a lot here. I mean, you contracted malaria at one point in Europe, of all places. But I know another important moment for you came shortly after the war ended, in December of 1945. In fact, just this week, you're celebrating your 64th anniversary. How special was that for you to come home and get married?
That was a very important day in my life.
In the years since then, every year the Doolittle Raiders have a reunion. And one of those was held in Fresno, and you flew over Carmel. What's been the two of them in Fresno? What's been the biggest thing you've gotten out of that, of those yearly reunions with the other men who had such a big hand in a very historic event?
It's great to get together with the other Raiders every year. I've made more than 40 of the reunions through the years.
I didn't ask you about the movie that came out, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. When that happened, when it came out, the war's still going on. Was it kind of a neat thing for you to see yourself on the silver screen?
When I came back from North Africa in January 43, I was stationed at Santa Monica, and I got to visit the MGM studios and meet all the crew that in the movie. That was quite interesting.
Once you got married, I imagine your wife enjoyed these reunions as much as you did.
Yes, we've been to a lot of the reunions throughout the United States, seemed like.
And even this past year, the most recent reunion, how many other survivors were there?
Only 4 of the 9 survivors were able to make it to the reunion in Columbia, South Carolina.
So there are 9 still living. Only 4 made it. I understand. And people that go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the National Air Force Base Museum or Air Force Museum there can see some of this. But you have some very special goblets that you drink a toast out of every year at these reunions. Tell me about that.
There are 80 goblets in a case that all of them have a name right when they're turned right side up or when they're upside down. You can read our names on them, one for each member of the Raiders. And they remove the goblets that the carrier or the Raiders that are at the reunion, and we drink a toast to all those that have gone before us. And then if any Raiders have died in the past year, their goblets are turned upside down at that reunion.
You've done this dozens of times, but I have a feeling that every year it's probably still a pretty emotional moment for you, is it?
Yes, as through the years, the number of Raiders has diminished quite fast, really.
And I've heard of this tradition with some other reunion groups, too. When it gets down to the last 2 guys at the reunion, tell me what you're going to do.
Well, there's a bottle of liquor that we're supposed to open it and drink a toast to all those that have passed on at the last reunion on two survivors.
You know how long that particular bottle has been saved? I believe it's Hennessy Cognac from 1896, because that was the year Doolittle was born. Has that been around there for decades and decades now?
I'm not sure.
Maybe one of the Raiders already swiped it and replaced it with something else. You intend to be one of those last 2 Raiders drinking that toast, though, don't you?
I don't know. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, you're looking pretty good for 88. Is there one thing that you'd like to share? I'm sure you get asked about this a lot, and I very much appreciate you taking the time to tell the story again to me today. Is there one thing that you think people really ought to know about the Doolittle Raid and its significance and what it should be remembered for?
I think they should be remembered all through history that is what happened.
You're proud of it, aren't you?
Yes, I am proud of it, yeah.
The reunion you guys had in California, the 2 in Fresno, one of them you made a flight in honor of Doolittle over Carmel, where he had been living. How was that one of your favorite reunions? Tell me what you can about that.
Well, they assembled 16 B-25s and loaded the bomb bays with fresh-cut flowers and flew in formation over the bay there at Carmel and dropped the flowers on the bay there as a final tribute to Jimmy Doolittle. We were flying in formation with all the Raiders were in a plane that General Hap Arnold used during the war to fly to the different air bases. And we were flying in that. And after that, they flew over around San Francisco. I don't know how they got permission to fly so low over there, circled Alcatraz Island.
Didn't fly under the Bay Bridge this time, though, right?
No.
So I know there's just so many incredible memories that you have. Another thing that's happened recently, and one of the other trips that I get to make calling sporting events is to Hawaii, and I go to Pearl Harbor every year. But my next trip, I'm going to make it a point to go to the Pacific Aviation Museum there because they have a replica of your airplane, the Ruptured Duck. Have you been there to see it, or do you plan to?
We were there some years ago. I don't think it was there then. I'm not sure. We did get to see and go to the cemetery of the Pacific in Hawaii, and one of the Raiders that was executed in Japan, he's buried there.
The Punch Bowl Cemetery up on the hill?
Cemetery, yes.
And there's so many things I could ask you about with the other Raiders, too, some incredible stories. What are you most proud of with that group of men? And when you think about the kind of people that they were and what they represented, if you had one paragraph, a nutshell version, to encapsulate the guys that you served with, what would you say?
It's been a wonderful group of men to keep track of all through the years, seeing them at the reunions.
Well, and I hope you make another dozen, 20, 30 reunions from here. Thank you so much for sharing those stories with us. Thank you for serving our country.
May I say some more?
You can say whatever you like.
Our oldest son was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he was killed in February 1970 at the age of 20.
And I'm sure, and I don't want to delve too deep for anything that's too painful for you, but I'm sure when that happened, it was another reminder that easily could have happened to you.
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything special that you do to honor his memory that you like to share about him?
Well, his name is on the Vietnam Memorial that's here in Missoula for the state of Montana. And he's buried at the Sunset Memorial Gardens. So.
Well, I say with all sincerity on behalf of our listeners and Americans everywhere, thank you for what your family has done to preserve our freedom and create the world that we have today.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's David Thatcher of Missoula, Montana, our guest today. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.